Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Jewish temples around New Hampshire saw gatherings, tears, shock, and anger in reaction to the Pittsburgh massacre at Saturday night Shabbat services at the Tree of Life Synagogue. Here in the Granite State, a candlelight vigil was held at the State House in Concord. And in Manchester, an already scheduled candidate forum turned into a conversation about the ongoing battle against hatred, bigotry, and violence. Today in The Exchange, we pick up on that conversation, how Granite Staters are feeling, reacting, and what efforts some are making to prevent these increasingly frequent outbursts of murder occurring in the midst of everyday American life. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or call in 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests who have agreed to come in at the last minute, and I deeply appreciate it. We're sitting down with Elizabeth Leahy, Director of the Civil Rights Unit at the New Hampshire Department of Justice. Elizabeth, good to meet you. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Jonathan Spira-Savette. He's the rabbi for Temple Beth Abraham in Nashua. And Rabbi Spira-Savette, I know you have a lot of work to do with your congregation. I really appreciate you taking time out for us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And also with us, Tom White, Coordinator of Educational Outreach at the Cohen Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Keene State College. And Tom, once again, I really appreciate you being here and
thank
helping
you.
Us out.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, and all of you, I want to start with some words from the mayor of Pittsburgh, Bill Peduto. Some very moving words from the mayor. Let's hear.
The outpouring of love and support for Pittsburgh is incredibly appreciated during this time. And there is a commonality throughout the world of people who have had enough of this type of hate based upon somebody's practice of religion or somebody's national origin. There is an outpouring that is being heard through the people of Pittsburgh right now of where people want to see society move towards. And it is not about finding ways to divide us. It is about finding ways that unite us through our commonality as humans. Let this horrific episode be another mark in the march of humanity towards recognizing that we are all one.
Again, words from Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto and sentiments echoed by leaders here in the Granite State. Governor Chris Sununu made these statements on Twitter. My thoughts and prayers are with members of the Tree of Life Synagogue. We cannot and will not, the governor said, tolerate hatred, bigotry, and violence in our society. And no one should ever have to fear entering their house of worship, regardless of their faith. The governor also said he has directed flags in all public buildings and grounds in the state of New Hampshire to fly at half-staff until sunset October 31st in memory and honor of those lost at the Tree of Life Synagogue yesterday. So there are some of the sentiments that we heard yesterday. Tom, you study racist movements, ethnic targeting, language, political movements that led up to the Holocaust and genocide. What's going through your mind right now at this moment, Tom?
Well, thank you, Laura. I think right away, obviously, grief. I'd like to start off by maybe bringing this a little more home in its reality. One of those who perished in the attack was the sister-in-law of the former dean of Keene State College, one of my former colleagues and associates. And so I just want to mention the name of Joyce Feinberg this morning. Nothing, sadly, is surprising given the rhetoric we've heard the last couple of years. To me, I have a mixture of grief, of anger. Anger that really, to this point, I think as Americans, we have a real decision to make. And that is basically, who do we decide that we would like to be? And I think we're in that moment in our history. One of the things that goes through my mind is this sort of idea that we're seeing here is somehow unique to the American experience. And it is woven through the fabric of our experience. But I want to be very clear to point out is this is a minority view. From latest polls, only 6% of Americans share the beliefs of the what's called the alt-right or the racist movement. And that is the case in Nazi Germany. The Nazis were a minority party. And I think it's very important to realize that we are the majority and we have a significant choice to make, whether we follow the minority into fear and terror and hatred, or we assert our values of what our republic is founded on.
Well, those voices seem so amplified, though, Tom, these days.
And that's absolutely correct. And I think while you're having a show like this, it shows the power of the media to diffuse this kind of thing rather than empower it, which I think we've been seeing on a national level with our media. This isn't an either-or choice. This isn't a relevancy question. This is a moment for people like us to discuss really what's at stake and to make that decision as the majority.
Rabbi Spear-Savet, again, I really appreciate you being here. This is a very tough time, I'm sure, for you and your congregation. How are people at Temple Beth Abraham feeling and reacting?
Well, also first, there's just this personal grief. And Tom, my condolences for you among your circle, too. If you know Jewish people, we really are a family around the world. And even though I've never lived in Pittsburgh, I know a lot of people who have and people who come from that neighborhood and for whom that synagogue was an important place in their life. And they know people there. And there's just a lot of personal grieving. And so this is a period of Shiva, of mourning, immediate mourning. And some of the things that we try to do are just to think about the ways we bring comfort to people. We were very fortunate in a way yesterday at the synagogue at Temple Beth Abraham in Nashua that we were already hosting a big gathering, an interfaith anti-hunger walk through the city. And so we knew that there were going to be people with us, and it gave a lot of opportunity for our brothers and sisters in faith from other communities to bring us comfort, and also for all of us just to be there, to come to a synagogue and a place of worship in an open place right the next day. And I was cheered by all that support and really, I think, by the courage of people to come, you know, without a second thought to a place like that.
So you were already participating in an interfaith walk for hunger yesterday.
Yes.
And that continued on.
And it continued on. And, you know, we're in many ways very, very practical and pragmatic during a mourning time. We certainly, as soon as services were over on Saturday for us, and I learned what happened, we were on the phone during the afternoon, and we don't usually do business during the Sabbath,
right,
to make sure that we were taking care of our people and the people who we knew were going to come, thinking about our own security arrangements, our Sunday school that was coming. So we were really focused on that. And now is the next day, the first kind of regular day, and it's the same kind of thing. I will say that as worried as we are by this kind of upsurge over the past few years in anti-Semitic attacks and incidents, that that I feel completely safe going to my synagogue, going to work today, going to services this
week.
You do. I do.
You don't feel like you have a target on your back.
No, I don't. And this was, as Tom said, one incident. And even though there's some uptake, I know and I see that that Jewish people have never had as many allies willing to stand up with us and for us as we do today, I think, in our whole history. And that helps keep me in balance.
Well, and by the way, in the introduction, I said Saturday night services. I know that services are Friday night and Saturday morning. So this happened during the Saturday morning Shabbat services. Elizabeth, I want to turn to you again, director of the Civil Rights Unit at the New Hampshire Department of Justice. What was your reaction when you heard this terrible news?
From a personal perspective, it was sadness. You know, it came in the wake of a shooting earlier in the week in Kentucky, where two black people were killed outside a supermarket. And to echo what Tom said, I mean, there is this feeling now of not being surprised that it happens, because it's happening with such frequency, and the anger and frustration that comes with that. And so from a professional perspective, you know, I really started to think about what I can do in my professional position and what the Attorney General's office can do in respect to not only reacting and responding to these types of incidents, but also, you know, how can we best support communities that are more affected by these incidents or targeted, and then also redoubling our efforts to not only respond to them, but to prevent them and through education and outreach.
Well, and I definitely want to ask you more this hour how your office does that. But you say, you know, responding to these incidents, and the Anti-Defamation League, from what I have read, says that there has been a 57% increase in anti-Semitic incidents just in the past year, in 2017. And you mentioned the attacks on the African Americans at a grocery store. My understanding of that attack was the attacker in that case went to an African-American church and the doors were locked. So houses of worship have unbelievably become targets. We've seen this at churches and synagogues and mosques before.
Yes, I think that's right.
Did you want to say something else on that? Okay, go ahead, Tom.
I think we have to also be very clear when we make those kind of statements. This is an uptick in this kind of violence over the last 2 years. And a lot of it is linked to the presidential campaign and what was being said, and it continues to be said. But I think we have to also be very, very clear that the majority of these attacks are coming from white supremacists who are Americans. These aren't Islamist terrorists. These are empowered racists in America who are white with that agenda. And this is sort of a conspiracy of violence of the minority. And I think we have the right to resist it and not submit ourselves to that kind of violence, but to be very clear to state what that violence is and where it's emanating from. Before this week, statistics give us about 71% of all terror-related fatalities in the U.S. are linked to the extreme white racist in America.
If we call these mass shootings domestic terrorism, would we approach them differently, Tom, in terms of, you know, investigations and research and so forth?
I think I might turn that over to Elizabeth. What do you think?
Yeah. Should we call these domestic terrorism?
I think you certainly can, and there's overlap certainly with the statutes that deal with bias or hate crimes and also terrorism. It's an act of violence coupled with, you know, a mental state. And so whether it's motivated by race or a political ideology in sort of how we define terrorism, there is overlap, and I don't think we should be reluctant to call these types of acts terrorism, because I think that's what they are.
I want to invite our listeners to join us, and then we have a lot more to talk about. Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Today in the exchange, we're getting your reaction and hearing about reaction around the Granite State to this killing this weekend on Saturday at a Pittsburgh synagogue that left 11 people dead and wounded many others, including four police officers. Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. Again, our email here in the exchange is exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, I really want to hear from our listeners this morning, what they're thinking, what they're feeling. So let's go to Winchester, where Peter is on the line. Hi, Peter. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks. I understand somebody may have already mentioned this, but I did not want this to go by without some mention of the two people who were killed outside of the Kroger.
Yes.
By the same kind of a gunman, one of whose lines was, whites don't kill whites. And this is all part of the same thing in the same week and should all really have the same emphasis, I think. And I just wanted to make sure that that point was made. This is all part of the same disease, I think, that we have to deal with. And I wanted to make sure that that got emphasized. And hello to Tom, with whom I've worked in the Holocaust Center at Keene State.
Well,
thanks,
Peter,
a lot. Peter.
Yeah, thank you. And we did mention definitely what happened at the grocery store. And we also can't forget the black parishioners killed in South Carolina. And again, the incident last week. So it's all part of this sort of rising allowance of racist and ethnic violence. So I really appreciate the call, Peter. Jared from New Hampton sent us an email. Jared says, my question is, with all these hate crimes and angry rhetoric, why aren't Republican lawmakers stepping up and disavowing this behavior? It seems they have been bullied into submission. Jared, thank you for the email. I did read those comments from Governor Sununu, absolutely saying this is intolerable. Also, Eddie Edwards, a candidate for the 1st Congressional District, was at a previously scheduled candidate forum at a temple in Manchester yesterday, and he also spoke out quite strongly. Rabbi Spira-Savet, I have to ask you this. There's been a lot of sort of blame game going back and forth, you know, who's at fault for this angry rhetoric, and then other people saying, look, don't politicize this. This is not a time to be political. This is a time to come together. And I wonder how you sort that out. I'm sure you have Republicans and Democrats in your congregation.
Sure. And it's, you know, it makes for, I think, a corrective for me. You can't label one political party as having all the blame for anything which goes on, which is destructive in society, because obviously you can't say that all Republicans are anti-Semitic. We have plenty of Republican Jews in our congregation. And I think what I've been trying to think about is, you know, one thing that I do think about, and I talked about this a couple years ago when the primary season was beginning, is that Jewish people in any group, whether it's a political party or an activist group or an interest group, have a unique role in calling out the extremes within that group. We have our experiences, and we're the ones who have ears to be able to hear things that are being said in our name, and to both to disavow them and also to call on people to disavow them. And that's what Jewish Republicans should do. That's what Jewish Democrats should do, conservatives and progressives. You know, when we talk about these things, we for Jews, when these things happen, our frame also includes terrorism in Israel against Israeli Jewish civilians or any civilian. And when people in some of the parts of the left rationalize that or normalize that, that too is something that we take as an anti-Semitic thing, and we expect people who are active in those groups to talk to and call out the leaders there as well. So I think there's a real empowering role for Jewish people and for friends of Jewish people who are in any group to really police this.
What types of language, Rabbi Spira-Savet, should be disavowed or called out?
Boy, that's...
There's sort of catchwords that are being called sort of dog whistles to white supremacists.
You know, on the one hand, you know, for one thing, I think, you know, Tom may be in more of a position to describe that kind of thing. And one of the questions I had coming in here is that, you know, there are things that the Jewish people have heard over the past century and a half, particularly that sound like they're targeted to us and seem like coded words. And I wonder now also whether they're being understood and used in a broader way. We talk sometimes about Jews as the canary in the coal mine when things are said about Jews, and I think in this country about African Americans, you know, whether that should cause us all to wake up. But there are also things that I think are being, where the meanings are being broadened. So when people talk about kind of globalism, which was originally a Protocols of the Elders of Zion kind of thing against Jews, I think it must mean something different now. And we should respond to that kind of thing, but not only because it's targeted against Jews. And if I could put you on the spot, Tom, I wonder what's the thinking currently about really who is being spoken about, or do people even know who they're speaking about when they use that language?
Well, I definitely want to ask you about that, Tom, and also mention that this person who did the shooting in Pittsburgh was upset not only at Jews, but the fact that this particular congregation was helping to resettle refugees. So there was a lot of anti-refugee sentiment there, and we should definitely talk about that. So language. Also, Elizabeth, I want to ask you a little bit more about, you know, what your office does to keep an eye out on these hate groups who might become violent, protect minority groups, religious and ethnic minorities. Thank you for the call and the email, Peter and Jared. And we'll take a lot more of your thoughts after a short break. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. You can always send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org.
Does your mystery machine leave you stranded at the worst possible times?
I think we're in trouble already. Look!
Haunted mansion?
If you're terrified by the thought of putting more money into your unreliable vehicle, why not donate it to NHPR and transform it into the programs you love, like All Things Considered in the Exchange, and podcasts like Bear Brook. We'll take care of the paperwork and we'll even tow it away for free. Donate your vehicle today at nhpr.org/cardonation.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're responding and getting your reaction to the massacre at a Pittsburgh synagogue this weekend, which, as we're hearing, has occurred during a time of rising anti-Semitism, hate speech, and heated political rhetoric. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We want your thoughts, reactions, questions. Again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. Elizabeth Leahy is here, director of the Civil Rights Unit at the New Hampshire Department of Justice. Jonathan Spira-Savette, rabbi for Temple Beth Abraham in Nashua, along with Tom White, coordinator of educational outreach at the Cohen Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Keene State College. And Tom, just before the break, Rabbi Spira-Savette was talking about certain types of language that, as he put it, you know, needs to be called out. And I wonder what you hear in terms of language that makes you go, that's concerning. And that's a signal to certain people that it's okay to go out and shoot.
Sure. I think what I've learned over the last, 15 years of doing this work is I've often isolated anti-Semitism, bigotry, hatred, racism as sort of separate approaches and categories, but they all dovetail and they all come together. Someone who's an anti-Semite is a bigot. These are the same people, just with a different kind of way to express that particular hatred. And I think it comes together in our national experience over refugees and immigration and racism. You know, up until the 1880s, we were a country that prided ourselves on open borders. That shifted post-Civil War when those promoting slavery were re-empowered in Congress, who then decided that they're going to use immigration and refugees as an issue to divide the country again. And so in 1882, there was the Exclusionary Asian Act, where Chinese people were not allowed into the U.S. And that was specifically done to rally a poor white base that was afraid of losing their jobs. And it's a tool that sort of enslavers had used, aristocratic enslavers, to sort of incite the Civil War, that somehow Lincoln was going to free the slaves, and therefore it's up to you to sort of fight a war for us, the rich enslaver. And so what you often see are this small group of people with some kind of agenda who will manipulate racism and fear for their own short-term gain. So when you're hearing, for example, that this supposed refugee column coming toward us is full of terrorists, and then you hear the administration reference the international Jewish conspiracy that is being funded by Jews who are targeted. I mean, if I was to say to you that we have a whole list of opposition leaders targeted for murder, and in the same week I say, and then Jewish synagogue was targeted and killed while other minorities attacked on the streets, you would be thinking I'm talking about Nazi Germany. But this is the United States, and it's not the United States the majority of us want. And so all this language sort of, for us, we like to reduce things into these categories, but it's never that easy. And that's what genocidal leaders try to do. They reduce multi-complicated and interrelated identities down to singular concepts, singular identities that they place you in a category they want to be taken care of. So I think all these things are coming together in a perfect storm for us right now, whether it be the white supremacists, whether it be the anti-Semites, or those who are seeking power based on division and fear. It is coming together and rooted much in our historical past.
You know, a more specific question for you, Elizabeth. We talk about hate speech. We do have free speech in this country. So you are allowed to say, you know, I don't like these people. How do you, in your office, sort of sort out what's hate speech and what's an incitement to violence? This person who, again, did the shooting at the synagogue had some pretty threatening posts on social media.
Yeah. So as a general proposition, you're correct that the First Amendment prohibits the criminalization of pure speech. And so sort of setting that aside, I think from our perspective, it's a huge mistake to ignore hateful speech as sort of being outside the realm of what we should be concerned about. And the reason for that is because oftentimes, as you pointed out, this violence begins as speech and escalates. And so What we've seen is in some ways people trying out this rhetoric and trying out to see what kind of response they get. And so if the speech isn't countered, whether by peers or whomever, it sort of sends a message to the speaker that it's okay and that people around me must generally accept this proposition. And from there, maybe it turns into conduct. And so from our perspective, while we can't, we're certainly, aware of the limitations that the First Amendment places on us and that should, but we still care from our enforcement perspective on knowing what kind of speech is out there. And so we track incidents that happen online. We receive reports of speech so that we can document it and make sure that we are providing adequate resources and support to prevent that escalation, and whether that comes in the form of education or outreach. And sort of a kind of dovetailing into our enforcement perspective or role, that evidence, to the extent it comes from the same person, can be used as, or the examples of prior speech can be used as evidence of bias and hatred later on in a context of a civil rights or hate crime prosecution, and where that evidence of speech is relevant.
It's so hard, though, because, you guys can't be everywhere. Maybe you see some concerning posts on Facebook or some of these more darker web sites, such as the ones that this man used. So you see it, but he hasn't done anything yet. So, and you don't have the staff to post, somebody watching him all the time. I mean, it's really hard to kind of connect the dots before it's too late.
Yeah, I think that's right. And so we, when we are aware of a particular site or a particular individual, we do track it. And we also rely on law enforcement and the public to also let us know what they see and whether there's escalation or repeat posts of a similar tone or, subject matter, so that they do get on our radar. Because you're right, it's impossible to sort of monitor the internet. And so everyone needs to be vigilant and respond and document these incidents as they happen.
It's so frustrating because every time there's some kind of mass murder, ethnically motivated or not, the killer usually leaves, breadcrumbs in the forest, so to speak. I mean, there's usually evidence, often online, that this person had a violent agenda, and yet we seem unable to stop it before it happens. That's what's so frustrating. Everybody wants to jump in. Tom.
I think it really, and I just so well said, and I'm so grateful, by the way, that everyone is here around the table this morning as we seek our way forward. I mentioned before that in Keene, for us, we really believe, and I think the strength of America is our communities. And when we saw what happened in Pittsburgh, I just wanted to point out that it was, two Muslim groups who right away rose $60,000 to help out that community over the last couple of days. And I had an email this morning about the loss of Joyce Feinberg from my Muslim imam friend from Bosnia who suffered genocide in the 1990s. So when we talk about communities, you see that illustrated in this story in Pittsburgh. But I think also for us in Keene, we're very aware of any kind of bigotry or anti-Semitism or racism. And we have this sort of coffee group that meets every month or so just to inform each other what's going on, police, mayor, anyone we can get together, who have the eyes and ears of the community. And so often, if anything happens within the day, our office finds out about it, the city automatically responds, documents it. So it becomes a community-level response, which really helps all of us out.
Yeah, it's tricky, though. Again, often it's hard to keep track of it all. And a lot of it's online, and you don't know where it's coming from. You don't know if it's just somebody, posting stuff and not doing anything, or someone is going to follow up. So,
right.
And police don't have unlimited resources.
No, and that's why we multiply our resources by all working together, and why the groups around the table here can help to multiply our resources as well.
Rabbi John, how do you sort of work with both offices like Elizabeth's, but also local law enforcement, to just kind of keep track on someone who might have ill intent against you and your congregation in Nashua?
Well, I know that in Nashua, we have a very close relationship with the Nashua Police Department, and there's a community liaison who, we have his phone number for any hour, and anytime we have any concern, no matter what it is, we bring it, and they're always there and responsive. And we know that both from the state and the FBI that there are that their ears and their people who want to have this kind of information. And there's never any hesitation about that, and we're so grateful. Again, in a short time, how we got a little, beefed up security at our big event yesterday, and And the people who came were just so grateful, and I think showed that to Nashua's officers for being there.
I want to ask you about beefed up security in just a moment, Rabbi Spiro Sivet, and you also, Elizabeth. But let's go back to our listeners. Lots of people joining us with their thoughts and feelings. Again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Michael sent us an email. He says, we don't need political unity. In fact, a monolithic civic political body is antithetical to the idea that the United States, with a right to dissent against the majority and authority, is bred into the founding of the country. Michael says, what is missing and has been missing for some time is any sense that the person across the aisle is acting from a place of goodwill. Instead, we strawman the other side and assume the worst of our fellow Americans. We are told the right is operating from a place of hate and the left is operating from a place of anti-American sentiment. Michael says, we need to look at the other side's argument in the best light possible and only forcibly reject those ideas that run counter to the fundamental right of Americans to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Clearly, the murder of Americans practicing their faith and any ideology that promotes it deserves to be rejected. Michael, thank you so much for your thoughts. Rabbi John, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, it was, and it links to something I've been thinking about as we've been sitting here. You know, I think it's very important to distinguish the extremes and the violence from the political mainstreams and the political parties, and for any of us who are involved in politics in any way, to make it easier for people to not feel that they're suddenly guilty by association. And you know, this I'm trying to choose my words carefully because this is a thought I'm having that I think is inspired by something that the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, puts out about the pyramid of hate, which is that not everything is the same between, let's say, misunderstanding of another culture, another religion, bigotry, hate, and then extremist violence. Obviously, one can verge to another, but we have to make it possible to access the people who are just maybe at the stage of misunderstanding, first of all. Jewish people have been misunderstood because of the ways, you know, historically we've been presented until the modern age in Christian scriptures and other places, and we've done all this work to create interfaith possibilities so that we can be heard. And one of the things that I want to make sure is that I have the ability to go to a place where someone says, well, is this what Jews are like? Is that what Jews are like? And to get to them before they start to fall down that slope. And if we start to polarize too much, then we won't have those opportunities. And I even think I want to be in safe situations where people can say, you know, words or kind of preformed thoughts that are anti-Semitic, so I can respond to them and meet them, and I want to distinguish that from the emphatic, you know, role of investigators and law enforcement in tracking down killers and potential killers.
Yeah, well, so echoing Michael's sentiments, enough with the assuming the worst of people on the opposite political side. And Jessica's calling in from Durham. Hi, Jessica. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having or taking my call.
Sure.
So I saw something online from Facebook about how several of the victims in the shooting in the synagogue were children during the Second World War, and the very explicitly stated that, you know, they survived Hitler, but they didn't survive Trump. And upon reading the article, it turns out it wasn't like they were in Germany during the Holocaust or in Europe during the Holocaust. It just, they were alive at that time. And so I was wondering about if your panelists could discuss, kind of on your previous commenter's line of thought, about incendiary media and how incendiary media is really kind of fueling these sorts of events. You know, I'm a Democrat and I am a liberal and all of those sorts of things. And I was a little bit shocked to see that on my side of the aisle, I guess. But I know that that sort of thing is really fueling both sides.
Shocked to see what, Jessica, specifically on your side of the aisle?
The incendiary sort of media representation. I mean, saying basically that Trump is Hitler. I mean, that's not, or was worse than Hitler. I mean, that's not necessarily uncommon. I know it happens all the time, but generally in my circles, we don't really talk about, we don't make those sorts of, you know, assumptions, because we don't want to make the other aisle the straw man, or the other side of the aisle the straw man.
As so, Michael said in his email. Yeah. Jessica, thank you so much for calling. Tom, go ahead, jump in.
First of all, I want to say, thank Michael and the rabbi as well. Beautifully spoken sentiments. And I think if we reduce this down to, is Trump Hitler, was Obama Hitler, was Bush Hitler, or when this all began, was FDR Hitler, how this all began, then we're missing the point, right? Leaders articulate what's present somewhere in society. So it's symptomatic of something greater. And we can never reduce things. And I think what you're seeing in media, to the point that the caller has made, is that we've fallen into this sort of either or, I'm right, you are wrong kind of trap. And it's the, let's have the opponents show up in the media, argue with each other, and there we have some kind of news. We gain nothing by that sort of either or kind of mentality, which reduces the argument to simple, easy camps, which, again, is not where we want to go. So for me, rather than arguing who's righter, and we do this with the Israeli-Palestine issue as well, a Palestinian issue, we look at really the faces of the targeted. My starting point in anything that I do is not, am I right in my position, but it is, what is the targeted person telling me in their experience? And if we can shift from either or, who's righter kind of mentality, to I can focus on the face of the other, to quote Levinas, then I think we have a better way forward. But I think the media does have a role in fueling this kind of adversary positioning that I think isn't helpful at all.
Speaking of, you know, the media fueling this adversary position, and we need to say who are we talking about when we're talking about media here, because there's so much out there now. But Vice President Mike Pence was asked about this very point. He spoke after the shooting at a campaign event in Las Vegas. So let's hear from the vice president on that point.
As the president said, anyone who does such a thing in a temple or a church should pay the ultimate price. For now, we urge every American to pray. Pray for the members of the Tree of Life Synagogue, for the fallen, the injured, and their families. Psalm 34 reads that the Lord is close to the brokenhearted. And let that be our prayer for them today. And let's also pray for the strength and wisdom to do everything in our power to bring these senseless acts of violence to an end. So help us God.
Again, that's Vice President Mike Pence speaking about the shooting at a campaign event in Las Vegas. That sound courtesy of CNN, by the way. Rabbi Spearsavet, what do you hear in what the vice president is saying there?
You know, for one thing, I have to say that over time, I've become more appreciative of the rituals after terrible things happen in society. And you know you're going to hear the words. And I think, do I need to hear the words? But it's really good to hear the words. And from all the public officials. And, you know, I did notice that when the vice president spoke, he talked about temples and churches, I think. And I want to make sure that we just make sure that we realize that there was a Sikh temple in Wisconsin 6 years ago, churches of different sorts, mosques that have been targeted. And, you know, part of that ritual has to be to be with the people who are targeted in that particular attack, and then to put that in the context of everybody in our whole pluralistic society.
We'll talk a lot more about this after a short break. And thanks, everyone, for your thoughts, reactions, questions. We welcome you to join our conversation at 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, state officials are looking for input on a 4-year plan on aging in New Hampshire. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour, the latest mass shooting, this time at a synagogue, leaving 11 dead, several wounded. We're talking about this. We're getting your reactions. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guests are Jonathan Spear-Savette, rabbi for Temple Beth Abraham in Nashua, Tom White, coordinator of educational outreach at the Cohen Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Keene State College, and Elizabeth Leahy, director of the Civil Rights Unit at the New Hampshire Department of Justice. One more time, our number here on the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, I want to turn to another issue, and that has more sort of down-to-earth practical issue, and that has to do with security at synagogues and mosques and other houses of worship, especially as we've talked, black churches have been targeted. The Exchange Facebook page got a comment from Jews for Trump, who say, we need to learn how to defend ourselves. Every Jew should be carrying and make it public. If this maniac knew congregants were armed, he would have stayed home. So that came in from Jews for Trump on our Facebook page. The president did say that he thought it would have been a good idea if the people at the synagogue were armed. So let's hear a little bit on that.
But this is a case where if they had an armed guard inside, they might have been able to stop him immediately. So this would be a case for if there was an armed guard inside the temple, they would have been able to stop him. Maybe there would have been nobody killed except for him, frankly. So it's a very, very, very difficult situation. And when you look at it, we can look at it two ways. But again, if they had somebody to protect people. Now, isn't it a shame that you even have to speak that way? Isn't it a shame that we even have to think of that inside of a temple or inside of a church? But certainly the results might have been far better.
Again, that's President, that sound courtesy of CBS News, responding again to the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue. And Rabbi Spear-Savette, after the shooting at the church in Texas, where I think 26 people died, a lot of houses of worship here in New Hampshire did go through active shooter training. And I just wonder what you think about that. And also this call by the president for synagogues to have armed guards.
Yeah.
And second of all, who pays for that? But
well, you know, first of all, in the rawness of this particular moment and my sense of responsibility and caring for the people in our community and who visit our community and my staff, I just am just thinking about their safety and think we have to talk about anything, everything. Certainly, even yesterday, I heard from members of my congregation. They want to know that we're putting it all on the table and making a thoughtful and sensible decision and not ruling anything in or anything out. And I just think anybody, whether you're a religious congregation or a place of business or a school, has to be responsible about that. Personally, as I said, and I feel very safe as a Jewish person walking around identifiable by my yarmulke on my head and in my synagogue. And I have lived in Israel. I visited in Europe around synagogues. I know that there's no such thing as an absolute guarantee of security. And I think it makes sense to do the best things that we can that make sense. And we also have to learn that how we're gonna live in an open society. Some of the things we're going to do are also not going to be in our spaces, and they'll be really important. The rallies, the vigils you mentioned at the State House, that was out in the open. There were no walls to protect that. And I think we just have to think about all of it.
Well, and Pittsburgh's mayor, Bill Peduto, also had some thoughts on this idea of we should have armed guards at synagogues and churches and mosques. Let's hear again from the mayor of Pittsburgh, Bill Peduto.
I don't think that the answer to this problem is solved by having our synagogues, mosques, and churches filled with armed guards or our schools filled with armed guards. I think we're dealing with an irrational person who acted irrationally, and trying to create laws around that is not the way that we should govern. We should try to stop irrational behavior from happening at the forefront and not try to create laws around irrational behavior to continue.
Again, that's Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto, that audio courtesy of The Washington Post. All of you, let's go back to our listeners. Lots of people want to jump into our conversation. Melanie's calling in. Hi, Melanie. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, or Boker Tov, as we would say. This is Melanie Zelman McDonald. I'm the director of the Jewish Federation here in New Hampshire. And first of all, I want to say thank you to NHPR for hosting this important dialogue that's taking place. I think it's unfortunate the circumstances that have led us to this discussion, but I think it's very timely and very important that we be gathered, Jews and non-Jews, to discuss these issues. So thank you very much. I want to speak just briefly. You know, we obviously have been very busy at our office responding to concerns expressed by Jews. I mean, there are many Jews in New Hampshire who are also unaffiliated with congregations who just simply practice Jewish life in their day-to-day and are members of less formal Jewish communities. I would say there's the most recent surveys indicated there were between 10 and 15,000 Jews here in New Hampshire. And you know, Federation has been working really diligently with all of our community partners to be proactive in these times. So, for example, in May of 2017, we provided a training in collaboration with the FBI and the ADL here in New Hampshire because, you know, as Rabbi John had said, we want to put it all on the table. We want synagogues to have access to all of the resources, tools, and expertise that they need to make their own decisions about what's right for their community with regards to security and creating a sense of safety in their environment. There are, you know, 20 approximately Jewish agencies in the state, from synagogues to preschools to Hillels on college campuses, where some of these debates are especially confrontational and heated at times.
Sure. So that's not just synagogues that we're talking about, Melanie.
We just want to make sure that everyone knows Federation is here and is working with our rabbis and our communities to get the resources and expertise in place so that everyone will feel safe.
Well, and Mel, if I could ask you
what each community decides.
If I could ask you a quick question, I'm so glad that you called. And again, my condolences. So we've talked a lot about sort of practical concerns, basic safety, you know, armed guards, yes or no. What about the bigger issue that the mayor of Pittsburgh brings up? You know, how do you sort of broadly combat the hateful attitudes that lead to violence like this?
Well, I feel badly because as I was calling in, I was speaking with one of your call screener and not able to hear that part of the conversation. But essentially, I think that you know, we're formulating that response now as a Jewish community, you know, locally here in New Hampshire and globally. There were, you know, two New Hampshire families that we know of that combined lost three people in this attack, and we're still getting more information from our congregations. But I think that it's a twofold approach. You know, one is, what can we do proactively in the realm of education to both be more present as Jews here in New Hampshire? Like, you know, Rabbi John said, let us not hide. You know, let's wear our yarmulkes and light our Shabbat candles and be in our communities having difficult conversations. And so what can we do in the realm of education, of being visible and being present and being engaged in a thoughtful and meaningful way? But also, what can we do to provide, you know, our Jewish centers of activity, which are all across the state, from Bethlehem to Keene, from Concord to Portsmouth, what can we do to provide them with some practical tools and best practices and expertise around securing their facilities and assessing their vulnerabilities so that they can feel, you know, proactively that they're doing everything they can to be safe and to keep their community safe and welcoming at the same time. It's a tough balance between welcoming and safe.
Right. Okay. Well, Melanie, really glad you called in. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And she mentioned Portsmouth, and we got an email from Nancy. Please announce the Interfaith Vigil in Portsmouth tonight, Nancy says. We do have information on our website about upcoming events and also some advice on how to talk with kids and especially teenagers about this. So there's a lot more on our website, nhpr.org. Elizabeth, while Melanie was talking, I could see you wanted to jump in, so go ahead.
Yeah, so I wanted to circle back to a point that the rabbi made talking about the pyramid of hate, and I sort of hesitate to use the word hate, but I would call it more like the pyramid of bias. And because in this context, we're talking about hate, but these beliefs and trends and manifest in a lot of different ways. And so it comes up in stereotypes and you know, preferences for one group over another that are sort of embedded in our society, in our institutions, in our systems. And so there's a book that's out by Robin DiAngelo called White Fragility, and it kind of
fragility.
And going back to the framing, I think you were talking about in terms of the media of, you know, this side is good and this side is bad, and she really rejects that construct to say this is not a good bad. It's a, you know, it's a spectrum, and sort of everyone's bias is at play, and one person's bias may manifest in a hiring practice, while another person's may manifest in something that we're seeing here that's extreme acts of violence. And so rather than pointing at one, you know, this political group is, you know, aiding and abetting this mindset and this is not, you know, what we need to do, I think, in addition to what we've heard here, is sort of be introspective and looking at our systems, our institutions, and how we can better include and be more welcoming, and so that we're not perpetuating stereotypes or biases that, when taken to an extreme, we readily condemn. And so I think the pyramid is an important thing to keep in mind, that you know, bias doesn't necessarily always manifest in this violent way, that it can be a little more nuanced, and we need to be aware of that in addition to condemning these violent and notable acts.
Melanie, thank you again for the call, and Nancy for that email on the interfaith vigil in Portsmouth tonight. And again, there was an interfaith vigil in Concord last night at the State House. And Rabbi John, I just wonder, you know, picking up on what Melanie said and what Elizabeth said, this idea of reaching out, even though it would be so easy to just lock the doors and stay huddled inside.
Sure. And I so appreciate what you were talking about, and my colleague Melanie as well, at the Jewish Federation, which is doing so much to help us throughout the state. One of the things that the Nashua Area Interfaith Council started to do really immediately after the last presidential election is talk about what all of our member congregations could do to help fight bias and create understanding. And we decided that it wasn't just about bringing people together outside or in neutral places, but inviting people in to see us in our uniqueness. So we've been having a series of House of Faith open houses, where people come in and see us in our element, and there may be stations in different places to hear about doctrines or see ritual objects or hear about just how our community is governed. When we did this at Temple Beth Abraham, there were about 50 people who came in, and it was tremendous to be able to answer all kinds of questions and to show that it's not just the rabbi who's a spokesperson. And and I had already been thinking, even before these last couple of weeks, that maybe during December, you know, when it's Christmas and Hanukkah time, might be another good time to do this, just at a time when people are already aware of this difference, and to convert that into an opportunity. I know that in Nashua, the Muslim community has been particularly active in putting itself out there to demystify itself and to have people come in. And I think more and more of these are good. I don't think they address the hardcore.
Sure, somebody who's going to come to a temple and say, "Hey, I'm interested in your faith and learning about it," isn't going to be someone who, you know.
But I think every time that we can talk about that, it's 5 minutes less airtime for the other stuff. Every time we can empower people who had a great and transformative experience, it's one less person or their circle susceptible to other messages.
There was an interfaith service of that kind in Concord, and there were Congregationalists came, Catholics came, Methodists came. I have to say, though, now, Rabbi Spira Sivet, you know, the shooter in that historically black church in South Carolina came in on a Bible study, and, you know, the people there thought, oh, you know, we're going to welcome him. Here's someone that maybe just wants to see what we're all about and wants to pray with us. So welcome. And he ended up killing 9 of them. So, you know, I hate to be so negative, but if you have one of these come in and see what we're all about at our temple, you might be setting yourself up for danger.
Well, I've thought about that even.
I'm sure you have.
I was thinking that on the way, about even thinking about talking about that and before, and that would be part, now we know, of the conversation.
I want to ask you about something that we have not touched that much on, Tom White, and that is this shooter's fixation on refugees. We mentioned it earlier, but one of the reasons he went to this particular congregation in Pittsburgh isn't just because he hated Jews, which he obviously did, but he was also very upset with this congregation's activity with a longstanding Jewish group that helps resettle refugees. So what's the connection there?
So I think we're back to sort of how small groups of people sort of project fear and hatred of others to get sort of short-term gain. And in this case, in our country, we do have refugees and immigration as issues that sort of dovetail now with anti-Semitism to achieve that end. In the 1930s, that was an issue, of course, as well. And there's so many echoes from the 1930s that we're seeing, whether it be fear of refugees. In fact, more people actually left the country in the 1930s than entered it, even though those who are saying we're going to be overrun by refugees, which is not, I think, the core value of Americans. I mean, all of us have a refugee background. All of us are seeking home as refugees and often find it here, especially the Jewish community, after all.
After all that happened in Europe.
And America is that place where refuge can be found. But I think when we start targeting refugees, it is a quick dovetail into any kind of bigotry that anyone wants to hold on to, whether it be anti-Semitism, racism, whatever it might be. And as Elizabeth said, it manifests itself in many different forms, a lot of it implicitly accepted without any kind of rational thought. So I would just say that, you know, it's a choice. Do we choose to fear the other or realize that the other, as was so beautifully said by the rabbi, informs us? And as we see these communities that are targeted, often minorities in our country, how much wisdom that they give us about what that means to be reduced, and yet they turn the tables and say, no, what America is about is welcoming. It's about looking at diversity as an opportunity, not a threat.
Well, all of you, we could have talked a lot more. I really appreciate you coming in, and I want to let our listeners know again that there's more information and resources always at our website, so check that out as well. Elizabeth, it was really good to meet you. We could have talked more. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Elizabeth Leahy, Director of the Civil Rights Unit at the New Hampshire Department of Justice. Tom, thanks for making the trip over from Keene.
Thank you, Laura, for what you do.
That's Tom White. Again, he's Coordinator of Educational Outreach at the Cohen Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Keene State College. And Rabbi Spira Sivet, thank you also for making time.
Thank you.
That's Donathan Spira Sivet, Rabbi for Temple Beth Abraham in Nashua. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.